Argue, argue, talk, talk, talk. Exaggerate, argue, pontificate, argue, just talk, shut talk, up. Talk. Why won't you listen? Argue, why won't you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
And welcome to Spouting Off. I hope you're listening live. If not, you might be listening on a podcast, but we are broadcasting our 58th show, February 12th, 2019. People tell me I shouldn't give the date, so you'll never know. But once you hear what we're talking about, you'll know that we do try to keep it pretty topical around here. And we try to talk about what is hot and current, as well as a lot of stuff that just keeps being important. Like, for example, I just had an op-ed out today. I usually scramble to get them done towards the beginning of the week. And it was called Respecting the Other Guy's Freedom. No, Real Compassion Respects the Other Guy's Freedom. So you can find it on Town Hall today. And if you like it, you can pass it along to your friends. Basically, it is in response to the amazing candor that the left has gifted us with. They finally are telling us the truth of who they always were. And I never expected that. I never expected that, or at least not in my lifetime. I figured eventually they'd come clean and tell us who they were. And now, you know, just to qualify, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that every single Democrat or every single liberal is a socialist. Frankly, what they believe is on the continuum of socialism because they all believe in bigger government. They know better than us. They want to control us. They want to tell us how to live, what to do. And that is socialism. But now we have card-carrying avowed socialists who are telling us the truth. I want to move on because there's a couple things happening. And we have a guest who's going to come on a little earlier than normal because he has so much to say and so much to teach. And that's true of many of the guests here on Spouting Off. However, right now we're looking at something really interesting happening in the news. One headline on the Drudge Report is former Trump lawyer slams Mueller probe and maintains that the president will be cleared. Knock it off and get it done. And simultaneously, we are reading that they aren't going to report anything in the Mueller report. They're not going to come forth with a report at all. Now, that's fascinating for a bunch of reasons, because I never thought the Mueller report, and a lot of watchers didn't think so either, was done in order to actually find the truth, was done to actually investigate a problem, because there is no problem. And in fact, talking to Russians before an election isn't necessarily a crime, but Trump didn't do any of that. What is probably most amazing, among many other things, is that Trump and his associates have basically had a proctology exam, and he comes out smelling like a rose. There is no evidence. What there is, and what has come out in the last couple of years, is evidence of collusion on the other side. So basically, as we know, they accuse people of what they actually do. My question for all of this is, why are there never any consequences for false accusations, trumped up charges, and framing a president in order to reverse an election that they lost? Why is that? Well, I'll tell you, it's not going to happen. There will be no consequences for that. Now, you know when people get accused falsely of rape and it destroys their life, it destroys their reputation? Why won't Mueller and his cronies ever get held accountable for these false charges and literally trying to reverse an election. We all know it, and yet it ain't happening. That's my question, and I'm just, shall I say an optimistic realist to say, or maybe just in this case, a pessimistic realist, nothing will happen. We will find out eventually that there was no evidence to do any of this investigation. It's not the money. It's the principle of the thing. Doggone it. And we'll find out that there was no evidence. And the people who want to keep believing that Trump is guilty of some fake collusion will still believe that. And the people that know it isn't true will have to suffer knowing that there will be no consequences for false charges. I want to bring in our guest a little early because he impressed the heck out of me. I have the pleasure of doing guest talk radio around the country, and that's one of the reasons I've been writing a lot more than I used to, and it is way fun. Number one, it keeps me on a time clock, and I got to write something every week. And secondly, I get the pleasure of talking to hosts around the country, meeting them, finding out what kind of style they have, just as an aside, and also the kinds of concerns in different parts of the country. As you know, there's a lot of overlap, but there's also a lot of overlap these days in local issues because the left is pushing these issues locally as well as nationally. So that being said, I encountered a professional talk show host by the name of Keith Hansen, and I'm going to bring him on right now. Hi, Keith. How are you?
I am great. It's great to be with you on your side of the fence.
I know. We're reversing roles, aren't we?
Now, nothing wrong with a little role play, but
exactly. You know, if they can do it in Dungeons and Dragons, they can do it with us. I am going to let you tell the audience a little bit about your background, about who you are and how you came to be a talk show host. Tell everybody about that.
Well, I've got a background primarily in law enforcement and government contracting. So currently, and I have been for quite a while now, a federal tactical counterterrorism active shooter response SWAT medic instructor trainer. And so most of my career has been in some capacity or another in law enforcement. And so I was down in Florida several years ago, lived in Florida for just shy of 11 years. And was in the process of opening a gun range when I butted heads with a rather ornery county commissioner. And in the process of basically going to war with the county commission, was invited to go on a radio show and to tell a little bit more about literally taking on City Hall, or more appropriately, the county commission. And so I guess I did a pretty good job, because about 2 weeks later, I had the host of the show call me and say, hey, listen, I need somebody who's seems to be pretty good on the radio. Would love to have you, fill in for me while I'm gone for a couple of days. And so started filling in for him. And shortly thereafter, I got the first invitation to host my own self-titled show, the Keith Hansen Show. And that was down in Florida, down in Naples, Florida. And the rest is history. That's pretty much where I got my start. And 3.5 years ago, started doing radio full time. And so now I do broadcast in New Hampshire and Vermont. From 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. And I got to tell you, it's a blast. You know, it's every once in a while, somebody is fortunate enough to do what they love and love what they do and kind of find really where they were supposed to be. And for me, it was, I've always kind of considered myself, I'm a square peg in a round hole world. And so being a conservative talk show host, I finally found where my square peg fits in, if that makes sense.
It does. And we are going to have the opportunity to talk a lot more about that, because you're a fascinating square peg, Keith. Since you do daily talk radio, before we get into some of the esoteric things we talked about last week when I was guesting on your show, what is, in your opinion, the hottest topic that you're talking about right now on talk radio? What will you be talking about, say, tomorrow?
It really depends. questions, because I mean, I take, yeah, I talk about a number of things, both on the national and on the national and international levels. And that it's pretty fast paced, and my segments are, you know, with the exception of my fourth hour, which is just basically freeform. The first 3 hours from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. is pretty compartmentalized. So I generally get about 10 to 12 minutes with each guest. So, I open up regularly with Michael Friedson, who's the editor of the Media Line over in Jerusalem. He and his wife, Felice, have done a fantastic job of establishing a very, very objective and unbiased news organization in Jerusalem. So I open up with him, and that's kind of the international front, specifically from the Middle East context. And then from there, I get into both national and international topics with other guests during the tail end of my 6 o'clock hour. And then I kind of bring it into a state level in hour number two, where we're talking about state issues, things that are happening right here in New Hampshire or in Vermont, because we broadcast into Vermont as well. And then from there, kind of really do the local stuff in the third hour. And then, like I said, hour number four is freeform. So it's pretty much whatever, you know, is something that's important to me, what I want to talk about. That's pretty much. Sometimes it's just literally an hour of monologue. Sometimes it's guests. As I had you on the other day, which was quite a breath of fresh air having you on, actually. So that was
nice. Thank you,
and,
Keith. It's fun. So I'm in love with it too. Same thing.
Yeah, no, it's great, and I'm the kind of person who, you know, my goal in life is to, I want to live to be 105 years old. And so the running joke is that at 105 years old, I'm going to be on my deathbed surrounded by people who are finally happy that the prospect has arrived where I'm going to be silenced. because I generally talk incessantly.
Really, Keith?
Yeah.
Why'd you choose 105? So you won't mind if I interrupt you every now and then just to get a question in. But I mean, you know, I can go like have coffee, anything I want. Why 105?
It just seemed like a great number. You know, I figured by 105, I would have whacked off everything on my bucket list that I need to get done. And by the same token, at that point, I'd probably be tired and be like, okay, you know what? I've lived a rich, fulfilling life. Now I'm ready to go teats up.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You ended up in New Hampshire. You were lamenting not long ago about the cold weather in New Hampshire, obviously, in the middle of February.
Yes.
But it is kind of a square peg in a round hole kind of a state, isn't it? It's the live free or die state. And yet now I think you are starting to, New Hampshire anyway, is starting to fight the not so slowly moving socialism that we are seeing across the country. Tell us a little bit about what is going on in New Hampshire as far as the left is concerned. Are they making inroads there? And if so, how?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the big thing was, of course, during the 2016 elections, New Hampshire has the distinct honor of being the first in the nation. So we have a lot of eyes on us. And, of course, it's always interesting to see who winds up coming to the state, whether it's to just attend a fundraiser or happen to headline a dinner. Because as soon as somebody shows up here, like Martin O'Malley was at a fundraiser barbecue with a former Democrat state senator who was a regular guest on my program. And so, of course, you know, I had the opportunity to get Martin in the studio and sit down and do a 45-minute interview with him, which was very gracious of him. And of course, I have to ask, you know, okay, so Martin, any presidential prospects? And of course, he did run in the Democrat ticket in 2016.
Yes.
You know, hey, Martin, any prospects? And he's like, well, I don't know, I'm just feeling it out. Of course, you know, in my genuinely sarcastic nature, I'm like, come on, like really, come on, this is me you're talking to here. Come on, you're up here in New Hampshire doing a barbecue fundraiser. Don't tell me you're not testing the waters for a 2020 run, you know? So it's always interesting to see who winds up coming up here and who is kind of ingraining or interweaving themselves in the fabric of the landscape of the state. And of course, right now we're just being overrun, of course, with progressive Democrats because, well, let's put it this way. It's, you know, it's their cycle. In 2016, we had our cycle and there was a tremendous amount of energy and enthusiasm that was generated by President Trump. Dare I say that President Trump's gravitational pull was such that, I mean, really, you could have Republican candidates that could fall asleep at the switch and they could still be elected. Of course, I separate former Senator Kelly Ayotte from that group because she's one of the few that managed to actually lose. But the foregoing notwithstanding, she is, you really could be asleep at the switch and still wind up winning an election, because again, there was just so much gravity behind President Trump. And so,
and isn't it interesting that in the midterms, there were still Republicans who tried desperately to distance themselves from the president, and those were the ones that lost. We had a whole bunch of them, sadly, in Colorado.
Right. Yeah, well, and it's the same thing here. And I want to say it was either the end of April or beginning of May, had a semi-private lunch with the governor, and there were about 25 other people that were in attendance with this. And there was a pretty controversial bill that he was looking at signing, House Bill 1319, which was affectionately titled, or colloquially referred to, I should say, as the Transgendered Bathroom Bill. By his own admission, he was only about 60% on board with this, but he announced that he was going to sign it anyway. And so there were a number of people that said, listen, you know, we're going to outright, you know, I mentioned Kelly Ayotte earlier. I don't know how familiar you are or your listeners are with the Kelly Ayotte story, but of course, Kelly Ayotte was the former attorney general of the state of New Hampshire, who was elected to be a senator. And of course, she was very, very vocal about the fact that she was not going to support President Trump. She's very vocal, never Trumper.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, going on record multiple times and saying, I'm actually going to write in Mike Pence. I had her on my program, and it was a matter of fact, it was on my show that I wound up catching her in kind of a hypocritical moment that was the soundbite of which was actually dissected by Van Jones and Don Lemon on, of all places, CNN. But, you know, it was at that point that I realized the number of people who were standing up and saying, we're going to Ayotte you, you know, referring to, I realized at that point that the word or the name Ayotte was not just a name. It now became a verb in the landscape of New Hampshire politics. To Ayotte somebody is to specifically try to write in somebody else to block their or to prevent their being elected. So,
right.
You know, there were, it was at that point that I realized that this blue wave that everybody was talking about wasn't something that I was really feeling on a national level, but definitely on a state level. My prediction was that the Republican Party was going to get shellacked. And primarily, one of the main reasons was because the director of communications for the state Republican Party, 3 days before the deadline to file paperwork to run as a candidate came about, he's on the phone with me that morning saying, hey, I got to get on your show because I gotta put a call out. We need people to run for office. And so, you know, my jaw is hitting the floor with this air of incredulity. Whoa, wait a minute. It's 3 days before the deadline.
Wow.
And you're still trying to get people to run for office. I hate to tell you this, Skippy, but this is something that should have been done a year ago. You should have had your candidates in line and training them a year ago, not putting out the call for candidates 3 days before the damn filing period ends. So,
right.
You know, it was at that point I kind of realized the totality of the circumstance. This really does not bode well for the Republican Party. And, you know, not to sound like an arrogant guy, but most of my political prognostications come true. And again, on that one, I was dead nuts on.
You got any prognostications before we move on to, I don't know, deeper? No, I mean, those are all important subjects. I want to get really into some of the stuff that we talked about off the air, although this is fascinating as well. Do you have any prognostications that you'd care to share, either in the short term or the slightly longer term?
In terms of what specifically?
Well, how about Trump and whether he gets reelected? That's always one that people wonder about. I have my own thoughts. What are yours? I don't generally do prognostications, but this one's fun.
Yeah, I think Trump 2020 is pretty much a done deal at this point.
Good. Glad to hear that.
I think it's going to be fueled by and large by the fact that just the there seems to be this push now among the Democrat Party just to see how far to the left we can go. It's like we're trying to out progressive one another. And I think as the left continues to push more and more to the left, now their true colors are really coming out. And it's always interesting,
well, and
of course, when there's
perfect
intense.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go
sorry.
Ahead. No, when there's intense competition, especially amongst progressives, that's where you start to see they start to drop the facade because they really can't maintain that image that they're trying to present. you really start to see their true colors come out. And so, you know, I think by and large, I think that the Democrat Party is doing a fantastic job. And notice I say Democrat Party. I don't call them Democratic because there's nothing
about them. I just I got hammered for calling it the Democrat Party, so I called it that twice.
Well, my answer to that.
Yes.
Yeah, my answer to that would be very simple. Okay, so you're the Democratic Party, so what you're saying is that you believe in democracy, but yet you guys rig your superdelegates and you rigged your primary to make sure that Bernie Sanders was blockaded in favor of your favorite daughter, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Absolutely.
How democratic is that? And you also
There's nothing democratic about the Democrat Party.
300 individual voters. So as far as I'm concerned, there's absolutely nothing Democrat about your party or Democratic about your party. In fact, you're totalitarian, tyrannical. So if you want to change your name to I'd be more than happy to
honor that it, is, Keith, the perfect segue into not only what I wanted to delve in with you, and you could do a little bit of teaching here. You may have heard in my opening that I just put out an op-ed in Town Hall called Real Compassion Respects the Other Guy's Freedom. And it's about the good news that, in my opinion, and I have just a slightly different take on it, but we still disagree, that it's a great gift that the Democrats are suddenly having this attack of honesty. In particular, I think Donald Trump has done this not accidentally. I think that he has this enormous gift for putting the Democrats' hair on fire and causing them to show their true colors. And it is extremely important as punch, that we take advantage of this unique opportunity of their honesty, because they don't tend to be very much, to use this to bring to the fore something that has been bubbling. People could say 50 years, 100 years, on steroids, I would say in the last 10 years for sure, this speeding train towards socialism that we've been looking at. And so we got to talking, you and I, about Marx and Engels and eugenics and all of this, and we are going to have to take a break, but we've got about 5-6 minutes. Then we'll take a break and we can hopefully you'll stay with us. Talk to people, you know, layman people, because you've done an enormous amount of research and study about this, to some of the roots of socialism. A lot of people, for example, just to get started, have a very difficult time understanding the difference between socialism and communism. A lot of people use the terms interchangeably, and in many cases they are very overlapping. But since you've done so much study, what would you say is the answer to that? And then tell us a little bit about where Marx and Engels were coming from and how they have influenced the socialists of today that we're looking at.
Well, it's a great question. And first of all, you have to understand that, you know, when people think about Russia, for instance, Soviet Russia, they often refer to that as a communist government. But the name of the nation was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic. True communism has never been achieved. It's always the socialism that comes as the precursor and basically the means of ushering in true communism. But communism, as it is defined, has never, ever been achieved, nor will it ever be achieved, because it fails to take into account one critical thing, which is the spirit of mankind. And I would encourage your listeners to look up Graham's Hierarchy of Needs. Because what Graham's Hierarchy of Needs does has really, it's mapped out, you know, in terms of a triangular hierarchy, what man needs to live to sustain basic life, and then going up the pyramid, it's crowned by what makes a rich and fulfilling life. And so, when you look at the top rungs of Graham, you're looking at things like self-esteem and self-actualization. And so, being a part of something, having basically, you can boil it down into having a purpose. When you have a purpose, and when people when you look at some of the people whose lives seem to be the most rich, and I'm not talking monetarily, but just in terms of a life well lived, then typically what you're looking at are people who have found a means of self-actualizing. They have an impact, a demonstrable or an articulable impact on other people. And as a result of that, they derive a sense of fulfillment and a sense of purpose from knowing that their efforts have directly impacted for the better their fellow man. And so when everybody is given a role and told to produce and everybody is the same and there's the suppression of the human spirit and there's the suppression of creativity and there's the suppression of self-expression, then you're stifling the human spirit, and that will never survive because the human spirit is always yearning to fly free and breathe free. That's one of the reasons, that's one of the critical flaws in communism. It fails to take into account the very nature, the very essence of mankind and human beings. So that's why true communism has never been achieved, nor will it be achieved, because you're always going to have people like me, those damn rabble-rousers who speak out against this and say, wait a minute, this is impractical, it goes against the very nature of mankind, it will never work, and we will fight to the death to make sure that that type of government, that type of totalitarian rule is never implemented on a free person.
And that's where it always goes towards tyranny. Because eventually, sooner or later, and this is exactly what I wrote, sooner or later, the guys in charge have to put down the opposition with more than just persuasion, with the velvet, right, with the iron fist. And that is how we got to people getting picked up in the middle of the night and never heard from again.
Correct.
And so that's where it always leads. It's always fascinating to me, the number of people that fall for the scam that's presented as utopia, you know?
Well, it's a very easy thing to sell when you're offering up free stuff. And, you know, this goes back again to Graham's hierarchy. I'm sorry, not Graham's hierarchy disagreement. but
is it Maslow? I was going to correct you, but I was afraid to. I shouldn't be. Abraham Maslow,
no, okay,
right?
Abraham Maslow, and then there's Graham's hierarchy of disagreement. Those oftentimes get invoked on my program.
Okay.
But when you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the very basic portion of Maslow, what is needed for basic human survival, food and shelter and all those things. Think about this.
Right.
Under a socialist government, or in order to roll out socialism to the masses, what does the government now become responsible for doing? Well, it becomes responsible for providing the basic needs that people need. And you know, here's the thing. There's a lot of people out there who have absolutely miserable existences. And so for them, an existence is an existence. They're willing to trade a certain amount of freedom and sovereignty for the notion that they don't have to worry about where their next meal is going to come from, or whether, you know, whether or not they're going to have a place to live, or things like that. So when you have this group of people who are not motivated, who are not self-starters, and who basically have no ability to self-actualize, what happens is you have a group of people who are now comfortable and willing to become dependent on the government for their basic needs. And
well,
let
me just throw in there that because the scam of socialism is so very, very terrific for the people in charge who don't have to live by the same rules as anybody else, they encourage that kind of dependency. It's not just that it attracts certain people. It's that they actively encourage this kind of dependence on someone else. And that what they're offering is also a lie. It's also a lie that someone else will take care of your needs and you get to go back to the womb and have everything taken care of for you. One other thing, Keith, and then we're going to take a break and come back in a minute. I want to leave you with something, and we will take a break in just a minute. I came up with this line that I'd love your thoughts on when we come back in my piece. By the time victims learn this bit of truth, it's too late. Anyone who can lure you with what they think you want most can control you with what they know you can't live without. That's exactly what you're saying, right?
Yep.
It's just exactly what you're saying. Hold on just a minute. We are going to take a break, and we will be back with talk show host and square peg extraordinaire Keith Hansen here on Spouting Off. Stay with us.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/askauntemma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/askauntemma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
We're back. You're listening to Spouting Off here on BBS Radio Station 1. I am delighted to have with us talk show host and philosopher, although not philosopher king, I don't think, Keith Hansen, who is a full-time talk show host in New Hampshire and a federal tactical law enforcement expert. Interesting fellow. When we took a break, I quoted my piece in Town Hall that just came out today. Anyone who can lure you with what they think you want most can control you with what they know you can't live without. And isn't it interesting that we heard a thing from Hillsdale College by Larry Arn about James Madison and limited government? Your thoughts, Keith Hansen. Thanks for staying with us.
I think you hit the nail squarely on the head in terms of what the foundational principles are. There are people who are willing to absolutely, as I said, trade their sovereignty and their freedom for a handout. They want to be kept. And so once they have that, they're probably not going to want to give it up. I mean, if you've got a good thing going, why would you self-sabotage that? It doesn't make any sense. So it appeals to people on a very basal level, and oftentimes I think people aren't looking down the road and saying, okay, well, what exactly is the consequence? I mean, there is such a thing in business. You were talking earlier about President Trump, and you think that. You had mentioned you didn't think that he did things just kind of off the cuff, and I absolutely agree with you. Part of being a successful businessman is understanding and more appropriately being able to implement a business tactic called the cost-benefit analysis. And so you know exactly what the cost is going to be, and you're comparing and contrasting what the cost is in the context and in the relationship to what you are going to benefit or gain from that. And so certainly the people who are trying to implement socialism understand what they can get by giving people things. But I think generally, by and large, people, you know, the general people, the people who are susceptible to, you know, the bait, the lure of the freebie, really aren't doing the cost-benefit analysis to think, well, what exactly am I giving up in exchange for this? You know, there is no such thing as a free lunch, even if it's a welfare meal. You know, it may be free on the surface, but what are you giving up in order to get that? Well, you're ceding control over your life. You're ceding control over your decision-making. You're ceding your sovereignty as a human being over to the government that may not necessarily have your best interest at heart or in mind.
Gee, you think? You think? So
I don't trust them.
Well, and they have such a good track record. The promise of the benevolent dictator is always an interesting one. And people are being bribed with crumbs when they take the bread. I want to move on to your book. You are writing a book, and it's very interesting, the topic that you decided to write about. You've been doing a lot of research. Tell us a little bit about what led you to write about this particular topic and what your research is all about.
Great question. So basically what this came from, I've got Dartmouth College, Ivy League school in my backyard. They're about a 20-minute stone's throw from where my radio studio is. And so, you know, we're constantly dissecting and analyzing and offering commentary on liberal education because, I mean, let's face it. And I actually want to kind of avoid using the word liberal, and I want to say more progressive. And so, you know, people, we've been talking about, you know, the progressive, both the college education as well as the public school. One of the things, just on a side note, that I would encourage your listeners to do is whenever they hear the word public, think about replacing the word public with government run, and it gives you a much more clear indication of what it really is. It is not public transportation. It is government run transportation. It is not a public school. It is a government run school. And when you actually call things what they are, it makes a lot more sense. It's a lot easier to be able to understand it in its purest, most elemental form.
Great
so
point.
In terms of the progressive education, one of the questions that has come up all of the time, and now that I understand the answer to this question, I ask this question all the time, and nobody can give me an answer because I don't think it's really understood. And that is, why have academic institutions, both government-run schools, public schools, primary and secondary schools, as well as colleges and universities, why have they become so progressive? Why is it on a campus like Dartmouth College, when we just had Dinesh D'Souza, as a matter of fact, you came and spoke last night, Dinesh D'Souza draws more protesters than he does people to actually go and listen to him. Why is that? Why are people so threatened by the message that Dinesh D'Souza is speaking about? Why are there so many of these kids who are just diehard Democrat progressives in college? And so,
but you're saying that you've never heard anybody answer that question adequately for you?
I've never had a person adequately answer that question for me. No. And in my quest to get to the answer, I was never able to find somebody who could say, this is exactly what it is. So I had to find this out for myself. And I had to study this. And that's exactly what I did. And as I started to study this more and more and more, it a very, very clear pattern and a very clear lineage began to emerge and to take shape. And so that's the foundation of the book, is how did we get from Marx and Engels to where we are today? Now, you know, Marx and Engels, of course, they're considered the father of modern socialism and modern communism. But going back even before Marx and Engels, you know, when you look at the French Revolution and the Vendée Genocide, there are about 170,000 people that were killed in the attempt to create this perfect society or a more perfect society. And so it's a pre-Marxist concept because the idea of a perfect society is really what is at the core of Marx and Engels and the writing in the Communist Manifesto. But going back all the way to Plato, I mean, Plato in his examination of six forms of government was ultimately trying to find the perfect society and what could go into a perfect society. And so he has this, you know, his more perfect and his less perfect are his perverted forms of government. Democracy, interestingly enough, happens to be one perverted form of government because democracy left unto its own devices will always devolve into an absolute despotic tyranny. But I digress. So, you know, the concepts that Marx and Engels wrote about were not necessarily unique unto them. They just did a very, very good job of compartmentalizing the concepts. And one of the main driving theories or concepts behind Marxism is from each according to his ability, to each according to their need. So in the perfect society, you have a group of people who produce and are able to produce not only to cover the amount that they would consume or be responsible for consuming, but they also produce enough so that way there's extras to go around to other people who need it. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it, but it's kind of interesting. In Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her new Green Deal, okay, we're talking about, you know, making payments or providing, you know, basically life services to people who are unable or unwilling to work.
Right. So, unwilling.
You know, that's really kind of that's kind of antithetical, really, when you look at a communist society or a socialist society. Because
which she's never lived in.
You need people to produce, which she's never lived in, but she'll extol the virtues of.
Of course.
And she's more than happy to blame the CIA for undermining the integrity of Venezuela's socialist system because, well, we have to keep the myth and the dream of capitalism alive. If you haven't caught that one, that's a really fascinating thing. That's the new thing. Uh-huh. The reason why Norwegian or Nordic socialism and Venezuelan socialism doesn't work and Cuban socialism doesn't work is because the CIA has been undermining the integrity of these programs to keep the dream and the myth alive that capitalism is somehow the best thing and that socialism never works.
I'm surprised she didn't blame Donald Trump, but he's colluding with Russians, so go figure.
Yeah, well, evidently. We won't talk about Senator Edward Kennedy and Viktor Chebrikov during the 1984 re-election of Ronald Reagan, where there's actually documented collusion. We can't get into that. Actually, fascinating. Dr. Paul Kanger, he's been a guest on my show.
Oh, yes. I have interviewed him. He is fascinating.
Fantastic guy. And, you know, I mean, there's documented. But when you bring that up, oh, well, that's like ancient history. Well, if that's ancient history, then I must be a really old guy because I was alive and quite conscious and aware in 1984. But
not so ancient.
Foregoing notwithstanding.
Yes.
So, you know, this concept of Marx and Engels taking it, how did we get from Marx and Engels to where we are today? And so what I began to do was search for the series of bridges. And so basically, what was the evolution of this concept of socialism from Marx and Engels to where we are today? And so the necessary component to understanding part of where Marx and Engels transitioned into what would eventually become the Fabian socialist movement, which eventually would become the modern progressive movement, is to look at an Italian socialist by the name of Antonio Gramsci. And Antonio Gramsci had a theory that was basically colloquial. It was called the theory of cultural and institutional hegemony. And so what the goal was of Gramsci was to take the Marxist theory and basically how do we get the Marxist theory to become the predominant worldview. Now, we can take all of Marx and Engels and we can break it down into a couple of key components. Number one, that a proper society needed to, A, have a group of people who could produce based upon according to their needs or according to their ability for other people based upon their needs. That was a critical component. The other thing that you would hear Marx and Engels talking about all the time was the bourgeois class. And so it's important to understand that the bourgeois class was the class of people that controlled the means of production and therefore controlled the wealth. And so when you look back in the 18th century into the 1800s, into the 1900s, into the Industrial Revolution, generally the bourgeois class or the class that controlled the means of production, so these were the people that owned the factories, they owned the plantations, they owned the farms, they owned all these things, they owned the land, they owned the resources, therefore they controlled the means of generating the wealth. They were the recipients of the wealth once it was generated. Therefore, they would control the wealth as well. And so these would tend to be dynastic patriarchies. Now, file that word patriarchy away for later because we're going to invoke that here in a minute. But the dynastic patriarchy, okay, was a patriarchy, obviously. It was a family-run business where the father would then grant or bestow onto his heirs, his children, the family business or the family factory, and then the wealth. And so the proletariat class, which was the workers or the group that made up this working class, again, you'll hear this if you read Marx and Engels, you will hear the word proletariat or the term proletariat described to, you know, when you hear workers of the world unite, well, just simply replace the word workers with the word proletariat. So if the workers of the world united, that collective would be the proletariat. Okay? So how do you destroy a group of people or a class that wills and passes on the wealth and the means of producing that wealth to its posterity? Well, you have to smash the patriarchy. Now, if your listeners go into Google and just type in smash the patriarchy, you'll be absolutely shocked at how prevalent this particular battle cry and phrase is today among modern progressives. In fact, there's the line of clothing, smash the patriarchy.
We've heard it a lot.
People don't even understand what it means or what its historical context is. But what it was designed to do, if the proletariat could smash the patriarchy, they could disassemble the bourgeois class and then be able to take over that which they would never be able to penetrate. Because, again, if a father has the ability to either will or give his business to his child or to a complete stranger, who is he more likely to pass that business on to? Unless there's
his
a hefty transfer of the business with money, he's most likely going to pass that on to his posterity.
Sure.
And so the kids take over the family business. And you think back to companies in the 40s and 50s and 60s, George A. Wilson and Sons. And so he would be grooming the children to take over that family business. Nobody was ever going to be able to infiltrate that little family, that little dynasty, because family takes care of family. Blood is thicker than water. So I'm going to take care of my posterity before I take care of other people who are not a member, who aren't blood relatives or who aren't a part of my family.
Right. Okay.
So Marx and Engels realized that in order to be able to smash that bourgeois class and to give the power and the wealth and the resources to the proletariat, it was necessary to destroy the patriarchy. This can explain some of the modern means of trying to destroy the American family. It stems from that concept. The destruction of man, when a man displays toxic masculinity, or when a man displays what are inherently biological male traits, then that man is displaying toxic masculinity, and that has to be downplayed because, of course, we don't want strong men. We want weak, wimpy, neutered, pussified men who basically it's hard to tell whether or not they're a man or a woman.
Let me stop you for a second, okay, to just ask a question here. I think that's a fascinating connection with a historical basis. I thought it was simply that there has been for a long, 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 long time a conspiracy to demean and demonize everything that the Western civilization has elevated. I mean, it's a textbook. You could check them all off, whether it's the nuclear family or it's competition or it's personal responsibility. Or it's free speech. All of the things that our country was set up to prevent tyranny and socialism, that's what they're after. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's kind of the layman's explanation, the layman's observation of what you're saying with a historical context. I think that's very, very interesting. Go ahead.
Well,
comment, and then I just want to ask another question here real quick.
No, go ahead.
Sounds like you had a comment. Okay. Can you start to talk about, because we only have about 10 minutes left, it's amazing how quick this hour is going, to talk about something that seems so foreign to most people. We've got a left today that, in my opinion, has lied, well, I mean, there's a lot of hangers-on that believe some of the bunk that they're throwing out about tolerance and compassion. Again, that's what my piece was about the fact that today's modern left is nothing of the sort. They're neither compassionate or tolerant in any way. But they're also obsessed for a political tool and for a weapon. It's constantly racist, 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 bigot, 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 homophobe, homophobe, homophobe. When in actuality, what we're beginning to find, and through people who have studied history like you, that the socialists of years past were eugenicists. I just got sent something recently by George Bernard Shaw extolling the virtues of eugenics. In other words, these are the precursors of the Holocaust. These are the precursors of manipulating and socially engineering genetics. who gets to be born and who doesn't.
Right.
So tell us about that, because that's chilling.
Well, George Bernard Shaw was one of the founding members of the Fabian Socialist Movement, and so he was a eugenicist. In fact, there's a very famous clip of him saying, you know, you must know at least a dozen people who aren't basically worth their own existence, and so somebody should sit them down and say, sir or madam, would you please justify your existence? Because if you are not doing something that is productive to society, or at least producing enough to cover that which you consume, then there really is no reason why the state should expend any resources to keep you alive.
Hubris. These people who decide for the rest of us who gets to be, whose justice gets, whose existence gets justified. This is people appointing themselves God, you know, pure and simple.
Well, absolutely. And don't forget that, you know, first of all, you have, I mean, when we go back, we can look at Charles Darwin, okay? And so Darwin, of course, the father the evolution, theory of evolution.
Evolution, yes.
And so Darwin heavily influenced Friedrich Nietzsche, and Friedrich Nietzsche, of course, the German philosopher who declared that God was dead and that the world need to be purged from Judeo-Christian morality. If there is no God, and so this is kind of the issue you start getting into with secular humanists, if there is no God, then man is the highest order because we're the most intellectually evolved, at least, you know, in theory, we're the most intellectually evolved. I've met some very intelligent dogs in my life who are actually probably more intellectually involved than some human beings.
A little smarter than some of the people in Congress, but we won't go there.
Indeed. But, you know, so if man is the highest order, man is the highest being, then there is no morality. It's almost like when you talk about, well, it's only wrong if you get caught. And so, you know, I would encourage your listeners to look up and start to understand Kohlberg's Six Stages of Moral Development, because it's critical, really, in understanding the evolution of morality in mankind. But getting back to the Nietzsche thing. So Nietzsche basically was saying that, well, God is dead. God doesn't exist, and we have to purge the world of Judeo-Christian morality. And in doing so, we also have to make sure that we can control those people or what people reproduce with. Because, you know, love is blind. I mean, you've heard the expression love is blind. And so people fall in love with people, and sometimes it's the worst possible choice for them. But, you know, they fall in love with the emotional love and they have the sexual desire for a person that may or may not be the most ideal mate. But for whatever reason, the heart wants what the heart wants, and, well, the genitalia wants what the genitalia wants. And so oftentimes people give in to those urges, both those urges of love and those urges of biology. And so we may or may not be making the best decisions for what is going to best benefit society. But in order for society to be perfect, well, man now has to help the species along, because left to its own devices, we can't trust that people are going to do what's best for a perfect society and not what's best for their own immediate gratification. Okay.
We have to say that perfect is in the eye of the dictators and the beholder. We know that, but I just want people to understand your sarcasm in case it was missed. I doubt it.
Well, you know, when you look at what that perfect society is, what is that perfect society? That is a perfect society where everybody is, I mean, basically look at an ant colony or look at a beehive. That's a perfect society. That is a society that is working in unison towards the common goal, which is the furtherance of that particular hive. That there is no individuality. Worker bees and drone bees and that, there's no individuality. You do what you're supposed to do, and if you stray outside of the flock, you basically get killed.
Kind of like the army.
There's one monarch, and that's the queen, and, you know, that's basically how it works. And so in order to make sure that the stock from which people could select their marriage partners or their mates, that's where the eugenicists came in and said, well, we're going to have to help nature along, because nature isn't doing a very good job of eliminating certain undesirable classes from the breeding stock. So therefore, we must do this to help nature along. And I invoke a 1912 document from an organization called the First International Eugenics Congress, that was held in London in 1912, and reading directly from that, quote, "Whether wholly of defective inheritance or mostly of good inheritance, but suffering from an insurmountable hereditary handicap, members of the following classes must be considered as socially unfit, and their supply should, if possible, be eliminated from the human stock. The feeble-minded, the pauper class, the criminal class, the epileptics, the mentally insane, the constitutionally weak or the asthenic class, those predisposed to specific diseases, the deformed, those having defective sense organs, such as the blind or the deaf." So
we're going to have to wind this up. As fascinating as it is, let me just throw in, we got about 2 minutes. You were going to sum that up, weren't you? Before I interrupt you.
Basically, yes. And so, you know, ever since it's the combination of Antonio Gramsci's desire to, through cultural and institutional hegemony, change the prevalent worldview, and then through the eugenicist movement to deal with those people who wouldn't necessarily subscribe or ascribe to the hegemony that ultimately was being sought to be created in society. And I would invoke Larry Grathwall, who was the FBI agent who was investigating the Weather Underground, the terrorist organization Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn in the 60s, when they actually said that they estimated that there would be approximately 25 million people that they would have to specifically kill because these were people who would not necessarily buy into re-educational efforts by the Weather Underground if the Weather Underground were indeed successful in actually overthrowing the government and putting in a radical Marxist socialist government. So,
let's just stop there for a second, because I'm going to have to sort of wrap this up. But I just would throw out the very interesting juxtaposition between what you're talking about, which I could talk to you for another 3 hours, and we don't have that kind of time. I wish we did. To the exact opposite that the left, the precursors of what we're seeing now, has been pushing. They've been pushing the opposite of what this all leads to. So racist, 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 bigot, bigot, bigot. But the irony is that they're the ideology, and the ideology that they are pushing leads precisely to the kind of genocide that America was created in order to prevent. America was created in order to support the kind of freedom that is the very enemy and an anathema to socialists. And the eugenics piece is something we don't hear a lot about, and it's very important. Everybody.
The eugenics piece, the important thing is to understand that why we're starting to have these conversations about third-term abortions.
Yes.
To the point where a woman could actually choose to abort her child when she was in the process of dilating to give birth. Why the Virginia governor is talking about making a newborn infant comfortable while the parents go through the decision process of whether or not they want to keep the child, and then ending that child's life. And more sinisterly, when you look at, you know, people remember Charlie Gard, people also don't remember Alfie, but Alfie was the first child before Charlie Gard in the British universal healthcare system, that here was a child who was determined to be non-viable. And so the state decided that neither the parents nor the state would expend any more resources on this child because this child would never be able to produce. So therefore, this 18-month-old child, or this 2-year-old child in the case of Alfie, both Alfie and Charlie Gard were marked for death by the state because they would never be able to produce. They had no ability to produce to the needs of other people. And so this is the end result of this.
And we think that European-style socialism or British socialism isn't tyrannical, but that's exactly the direction they're going.
Well, we were accused of fear-mongering when we were talking about death panels, but you know what? The death panels are absolutely real because the death panels sit down and determine a person's viability to determine whether or not they are justified in receiving any additional resources from the state.
Exactly. And it's a chilling ideology that people wouldn't imagine in Western civilization that we would have to face yet again. Tell everybody how they can get a hold of you, contact you, Twitter you, follow you on Twitter, and maybe even listen
Twitter
to some of your podcasts.
No, Twitter is at Real Keith Hansen. That's at Real Keith Hansen on Twitter. And you can listen to podcasts of my show at WNT WNTK.com. That's WNTK.com. Email is really simple and easy too. Keith@WNTK.com. If anybody wants to reach out, I'm happy to share, materials and resources from my research, but I think this is stuff that people need to be aware of, and it's the best that I can do until, my book actually comes out. So.
Boy, I encourage you. We absolutely want to read that book. That is for sure. It's a book that I think is very important. It couldn't be more important today. We've gone a little long because we've had a fascinating guest. Thanks so much, Keith Hansen, for being with us here on Spouting Off. If you'd like to get
Aaron
a little
Cataline,
me,
it's
you...
been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It has been my pleasure as well. You take
Keep
care, and we will stay in touch. Absolutely. Thanks for your
All
time.
Right.
We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Yes, when you you can connect with me at www.KarenCataline.com, Facebook @KarenCataline, Twitter @KarenCataline. Thank you to Doug and my producer at BBS Radio, and HW, the multi-talented guy with the IQ greater than that of a small soap dish. And tune in next week when there's going to be a whole lot more to spout off about here on Spouting Off.